Welcome to Books on Monday, a podcast from Portico at portifex.com.
James Schuyler was a core member of the New York School of Poets, but he also wrote a few novels, and one of them, What's for Dinner, originally published by the Black Sparrow Press in 1978, has been reissued by NYRB Classics, with an afterword by James McCourt. It's delightful, engrossing, and deeply naughty. It's also the work of a poet who attends to the weight of every word. To what extent Schuyler was influenced by Ivy Compton Burnett, I can't say, and it's possible that there was no influence at all, that Schuyler simply hit on the same dry exchange of conversation between the hypersensitive and the hyperarticulate. To an American ear, at any rate, Schuyler is a lot funnier than Compton Burnett, if only because he is not wreaking revenge upon repressive Victorians. Indeed, although his book is set in an unnamed town that seems largely suburban, and its time appears, despite the copyright, to be about 1966, there is very little repression of any kind on view here. That's not to say that there isn't enough polite hypocrisy to keep us smiling guiltily. In the first of the novel's 12 chapters, we are introduced to all but one of the principal characters, and to such vices and virtues as they possess. Lottie and Norris Taylor are entertaining Maureen and Brian Delahanty, together with Brian's mother, Biddy, and the Delahanty's teenage twins, Patrick and Michael. Schuyler lets them reveal themselves in artless self-expression. Here is the first and half-hearted stab at saying goodnight and goodbye. Lottie stifled a yawn. "Excuse me," she said, and went out to the kitchen. Norris got up and silently followed her. They returned shortly. Lottie stumbled slightly on the edge of a carpet. The others took no notice. "We really ought to be running along," Maureen said. "Oh, no," Lottie said. "Brian hasn't begun to finish his cigar." "Yes," Norris said. "What's all the rush?" "It's partly the boys," Maureen said. "What with school and training and their music, they seem to need a great deal of sleep." "Slugabeds," Brian said. "They can't sit down to study without falling asleep over their notebooks." "I ran 2 miles before breakfast," Patrick protested. "Yes, it's Michael who's in love with his pillow," their mother said fondly. "Sometimes I still have to pull the covers right off him." "You ought to give the job of rousing them out to me," Brian said, carefully knocking the ash off his cigar. "This seems too fine an object to be used as an ashtray." Lottie shrugged. "That's what my great uncle used it for, and I certainly haven't any other use for it. I'll leave it to you in my will." This was greeted by some rather hollow chuckles. "I hope we're not keeping you from any of your favorite TV programs," Biddy said. "We hardly turn the thing on," Norris said, "except for the news and the odd special event, like the president's speech." "Oh, did you catch that too?" Maureen said. "I thought he made some telling points." Norris let this pass, as the two families voted different tickets. End quote. Lottie stumbles on the carpet because she's been taking slugs from a vodka bottle in the kitchen all evening, and Schuyler notes that, quote, "the others took no notice," only as a signal for the post-mortem, when their respective families are home alone. "I wonder what gives a person the idea that you can't smell vodka," Brian asked as he shed his garments. "Did you catch her breath?" "Secret tippling," Maureen said. "It never ends well. It went to my heart when she almost fell over that rug. I must say Norris puts a good face on it." "Norris isn't a lawyer for nothing." Lottie's drinking problem, however, does come to a good end, even if it is via the psychiatric wing of the local hospital. Schuyler, himself the victim of several mental breakdowns and the author of the Payne Whitney poems, named after Manhattan's most prestigious psychiatric facility, sets much of What's for Dinner in the commons room at the hospital, but you mustn't let yourself worry that this makes for glum reading. The patients, who are usually seen in group therapy, together with assorted family members, chatter away with much the same empty politeness as we have seen in the Delahanty's farewell. Their petty complaints, thoughtless insults, and pious hopes are presented in a lucid dry point that quite transcends social criticism. Schuyler eagerly avoids every temptation to suggest that he has captured a slice of, quote, "what's wrong with America." It's not really clear that there's anything wrong with anybody. One of the patients, for example, is a Mrs. Judson, who, when she arrives, is deferential and mousy. Then she goes through a paranoid semi-psychotic phase, during which she construes every remark, no matter how directed, as a pejorative comment upon herself. Eventually, however, she comes to see that her fears are groundless. Whether she reaches enlightenment all on her own, or with the help of Dr. Carney, the shrink who runs the sessions, and who is the only character in the book whose ears I'd like to box, or thanks to some magical medication, is never made clear. We never do find out what was wrong with her. If we know all too well what's wrong with Mrs. Bryce, whose husband actually calls her mother, we're never told what took her beloved son, daughter-in-law, and three grandchildren from amongst us. Were they in a plane crash? Did they eat contaminated food or perhaps suffer the fate of the Clutter family? Not the faintest hint is dropped. This leaves us with a Mrs. Bryce who is sick with a sadness that she too eventually overcomes. Even nasty Greg Mulwin, the owner of three or four drugstores who has overworked himself in the conviction that he can't count on any of his employees, turns from nasty to nice, or at least to mordant. When the patients aren't in group, they're in crafts, making moccasins and knotted belts, if they're not more aesthetically inclined toward drawing and sculpture. During one session, late in the novel, Mrs. Bryce gets some good news. "Guess who's going to be released," she said. "Oh, Fanny," Lottie said, "I'd give you a hug, only I'm all over paint. That's the most marvelous news." "Congratulations, Mr. Carson," a patient who has slit his wrists said. "I wondered what you and were doing here anyway. You seem quite rational and capable to me." "I wasn't when I came here," Mrs. Bryce said. "In my own way, I felt almost as low as you do. Oh, dear, I feel all a twitter. Do you think I'll really be able to cope and not slide back?" "I'm certain of it," Lottie said. "You've regained your natural equilibrium. It was temporarily shaken, but now you've got it back. We must promise to keep in touch." "I'll be coming back for evening sessions for a while," Mrs. Bryce said, "and to see Dr. Kearney, an easing off process." Mr. Mulwin, Mrs. Judson, and Miss Pride joined in the general congratulations. "It hardly seems worthwhile going on with this belt," Mrs. Bryce said. "Still, if I knot away today and tomorrow morning, I'm not leaving until tomorrow afternoon, I might get it finished." She seated herself and went on with her deft handiwork. The absurdity of the psychiatric wing may be happier than most, but it is still absurd. And yet it is also liberated. Lottie more or less cures herself of her dipsomania by talking about it incessantly, never failing to announce her longing for a whiskey sour. This turns out to be her odd way of keeping the consequences of her drinking problem firmly fixed before her, and never in the event does a drink seem attractive enough to risk revisiting them. Meanwhile, on the outside, surreptitious corruption is on the march, although again, Schuyler isn't the least bit judgmental about it. The Delahanty twins, amiable jocks who are almost innocently dishonest, smoke some marijuana and try to score some more. Patrick steals the odd $5 bill, and Michael creeps into his bed for some unwelcome mutual masturbation. Brian and Maureen treat the twins like little boys, but they're also aware that their sons have grown too big to take a thrashing lightly. They'll probably grow up to be as self-righteous and lazily virtuous as their father, but right now they are going through a sweetly rotten phase of adolescence that clearly captures Schuyler's prurient imagination. He's much cooler about the affair that Norris Taylor conducts with Mag Carpenter, a recent widow. Norris is very good in bed, and he mouths sweet nothings from time to time, but his investment in the relationship is as heartless as Mag's is totalizing. The lovers think that their attachment is discreetly hidden, but not only does Maureen sniff it out and confront Mag with it, for her own good, of course, but Lottie divines it as well. You could say that Schuyler is unsympathetic to Mags' neediness, or you could complain about his man's world misogyny, a bond that few straight and gay men seem to be aware of sharing. Just as Schuyler has the nerve to call one of his patients Fanny Bryce, so he calls Brian Delahanty's mother Biddy. That's just what she is, an old biddy. She may be hard to dislike, but everything that she has to say was digested and packaged decades ago, to be produced as needed like a patent medicine. While she and her daughter and Mag Carpenter are having tea, an early scene, Patrick glumps in. "Are you two on the outs again?" Biddy asked. "I can always tell. You can't fool your old gran." "Look at you," Mag said. "First you shot up like a beanpole, and now you've filled out." "Why is your hair wet?" Biddy asked. "I took a shower after practice. I always do." "We never went out with wet hair. It's a wonder to me you aren't all dead of pneumonia. Then where would the football team be?" Seen in a certain light, a better name for what's for dinner would be Modern Scream. But Lily Tomlin, it appears, had made use of that name 3 years earlier. Too bad.
You've been listening to Friday Movies, a podcast from Portico at portifex.com.